Welcome to the OpenIC, the show where we talk to the movers and shakers in M&A, the teams behind the deals, and how the deals really went down. This show is brought to you by FinTalent.io, the hiring and project platform for M&A and strategy professionals. I'm your host, Toby Liebsch. All right. OpenIC, today with Tiana Whitehouse. Tiana, we have a bit of a different format today because you had a couple of very interesting opinions and after our last conversation. So instead of doing the regular interview-ish format, I decided, hey, why don't we just take some of your more controversial opinions and actually go through them, where I'm going to try to kind of challenge it a bit sometimes. I know you're the expert, so it might be difficult, but yeah, I'm really, really excited about this. But before we get started, maybe you can quickly give us an intro of who you are and what we can expect from you.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for having me. So I originally started out my career as a litigator in the US. So fairly intense, background, lots of antagonistic communications, very large scale potential damages. And ultimately ended up working in risk advisory with the Big Four. Did a lot of anti-money laundering and fraud investigation work as well, and segued into working for the Financial Markets Authority in New Zealand. So yeah. I did a variety of roles with the regulator that allowed me to, see inside businesses, licensing and monitoring engagements. And then also I did some policy work as well. So helping to reform the financial advice regime in New Zealand and, helping it to be, I guess, tech neutral. And then the last few years, I've been doing a lot of consulting for global clients, including derivatives platforms, fintechs, crypto startups, neobanks, all of the good stuff.
That kind of sounds like you would actually be a very good recruit for shady businessmen.
I do get approached quite a bit from people who are looking for, I guess, a reputable name to attach to their board or, to assist them with some regulatory endeavors. And it's fairly common that happens, but we're quite picky here about who we take on as clients. So,
choosing the light side. There's this German late night show host, Jan Böhmermann, who is also from my hometown, Cologne. And he always said that policemen are the same as gangsters. They just chose the other side. So I guess a similar thing could apply to what you were doing as well.
I mean, they all have the same toys, right? But it's interesting because having segued in and out of regulatory and then back out into industry and then back in, you do see things from all different angles. And so, I understand the viewpoints of where people are coming from, but, it doesn't make it any easier to navigate.
Exactly. So what today's conversation is going to mostly tackle is, of course, your domains of expertise, the compliance world, risk and compliance, especially also, and that was some of the opinions you also mentioned when it comes to fintech and crypto. So I'm really, really curious where we're going to end up and what we're going to learn today. And let's actually start with also the first point on your list, but this is something that kind of triggered me a bit because one of the reasons I know you're in Berlin now. I'm originally from Germany. I moved away from Germany kind of because of the bureaucracy. That was one of the reasons. So
really shocking. The red tape here was too
shocking,
much.
Right? So for me, the bureaucracy and the regulation, somewhat obsession with compliance often has a bit of a negative connotation. But you actually said, hey, this can actually be a competitive advantage or not even competitive advantage, but revenue generating activity. So what the hell do you mean with that?
I mean, it is, right? So, I mean, this is a traditional view that people have, right? Yeah. Compliance are back office function. No one likes them. It's like being internal audit, right? You're just not the most popular person at the party. But if you're planning to become a regulated business and you're going to have to go through all of these processes and procedures to get that license or authorization, why would you not also use that as a competitive advantage? And what I mean by that is, use it as part of your marketing activities. And we've seen this in the U.S. There are a few larger businesses recently who have gone through, you know, fairly intense financial audit and then published the results of that, I guess, as a way of showing that they would be financially sound for retail investors. And, you know, I've also seen this happen with IT security audits as well. So if people are concerned about, you know, how secure their assets are going to be with you, and you have to go through these security audits anyway, why not publish the results?
Yeah.
And in terms of revenue generation, this is something I see all the time with CFOs when I'm looking at, you know, business plans and projections is, you know, you've only got marketing activity or, you know, customer acquisition as your revenue generating activity. But again, if you can't operate and actually onboard retail investors without having a license, then you should be looking at risk and compliance as a revenue generating activity, because without that, you literally cannot generate revenue. I mean, it's kind of just something that you have to do it, but you should also just pivot, I think, you know, what you see the value of it as. And for us, it's that strategy. It should be a strategic function that's brought in at the earliest stages to help companies avoid making mistakes that are made over and over again and ultimately tank a lot of startups.
Okay. So to understand this, it's kind of the prerequisite for actually making revenue, sustainable revenue. On the other hand, you also, it's kind of a USP that you can actually communicate openly in the market as well, if you take care of properly. Nice.
Yeah. I mean, we're in a position now where retail investors have more choice than they've ever had, right? And, you know, something that we're seeing a lot of now is that a customer might onboard with a platform, make a few trades, and then never again engage with that platform because, you know, something bigger and better has come along. So, you know, to make yourself stand out, you should be, you know, promoting the fact that you have a safe and secure environment and that, you know, the governance and culture of your business are in alignment with the values of your investors. And, you know, we're seeing more and more of this with ESG being factored into, you know, financial projections and disclosure. So, why not lean into that?
Yeah. That makes total sense. Have you seen any change narrative over the last 2 or 3 weeks now that we see kind of a more harsh economic environment coming up?
I mean, people are scared to be the first mover when it comes to this, right? Like it's the classic PR cycle, like wait 24 hours before you make any public comment. and I haven't noticed too much other than, I guess, below the radar, I wouldn't say gossip, but just information coming to me that, you know, companies are pivoting their strategies a bit now and, you know, potentially offboarding excess hires, reallocating where their funding is going to need to be. And this was always going to happen anyway, but it's definitely sped up given recent events.
Absolutely. So is my understanding also correctly that some of the hiring freezes or even massive layoffs today are right about Klarna. So it feels like every day there's a new, especially in the fintech space, a new layoff or like massive layoffs is being announced. So would you agree that this is also partially to the wrong risk assessment? I mean, many of these people that were hired in kind of January, February are now being laid off again, which to me just screams for a company that hasn't really assessed these risks properly, right?
Yeah, well, it's poor planning. It's also just failure to recognize that regulatory change is happening. And the thing with Klarna is the writing has been on the wall for this for well over a year. I mean, if you look at BNPL IPOs globally and what's happened with their stock prices, it's very clear that this is an industry that is suffering from regulatory change, right? Like, I think I read yesterday, it's no longer going to be buy now, pay later. It's buy now, pay now. Because, you know, regulators are having rightful concerns about some of the issues with consumers falling into these debt cycles and not fully understanding what it is that they're taking on. Because let's be honest, Klarna, beautiful product, make it very easy for you to, you know, complete that purchase and perhaps not think about what you would normally have to think about for a typical consumer credit contract. But you know, the laws are changing and it's been in the news for the last year. So I always think if there's major regulatory change happening in a specific sector, usually about 9 months to 12 months later, you can expect to see some changes in how businesses are addressing that.
Yeah. That's actually an interesting question, Tiana, because one thing that I never fully understood, so I wouldn't consider myself a payment technology expert, because I mean, there's just so many layers to dive down into that you really have to kind of fully commit to it. But what I never understood about the BNPL business model versus a Visa or MasterCard, because I kind of see that, like, for me as an outsider, it looks like, okay, this is just a credit card or very similar to a credit card. There are some mechanics that work slightly differently, but it's at the end of the day, the same kind of model. You buy something and the payment has to happen at a later stage, depending on what kind of model you have, right?
Exactly.
But to me, it always looked like, okay, they just kind of name it differently, but actually the same thing, but they're just trying to kind of circumvent some regulatory loopholes. Like what's going on there? Am I completely off the wrong track, or is that kind of what's happening?
No, I mean, it was definitely a creative way to bypass that. And, you know, providing that B2B payment service is pretty smart, right? Because that's one of the biggest complaints you get with small to medium-sized businesses, especially consumer-focused ones, is that those fees can really start to eat up profit margins and make it hard to get off the ground. But, I mean, the interesting thing about Klarna is, you know, when they started, it was, well, the retailers are paying the fees. And I guess that was probably one of the fundamental differences between your traditional credit card model.
Yeah.
But also, people weren't having to undergo a credit check before they could, you know, take out some of these smaller loans, and that's where you start getting into problems.
Yeah. All right. When you talk about regulated business, by the way, are we specifically talking about fintech businesses, or do you also deal with other industries that are similar, or is it all fintech? Because that's where the most of the regulation happens in this case.
Yeah, I mean, I think fintech is more interesting just because it's had more movement over the last 5 years or so. But no, I've done everything from, you know, your traditional brick and mortar banks to, you know, traditional financial advice businesses. Yeah. But fintech I find to be the most interesting from a policy perspective, because I've actually been in the position of having to try and draft new legislation that can accommodate technology that doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think about how we're becoming, well, we already are this global marketplace, but the challenges inherent in that when it comes to protecting consumers who can now access products and services from basically anywhere.
Yeah, I gotcha. That makes sense. So when starting a new company, because with some of your opinions, you're also implying, okay, this is something that companies have to think about really early. And we just kind of tackled upon, okay, when a company is growing, that this is an important activity to look at for revenue generation. But especially for smaller companies, the common narrative is always, okay, you have to build, hustle, build, break rules, you know, learn things later, you know, I just forgot the Facebook motto, like move fast, break things, all this kind of stuff, and regulation comes later, right? Your opinion seems to be a bit different in the sense that, like, understanding legal compliance risk functions is really, really important, especially also in the beginning. Can you elaborate a bit on that and why you think that's so important?
Absolutely. I mean, and this is where I think the whole just-in-time model has maybe done a bit of a disservice to this industry, because look, we're tech companies, right? And that's what you're doing. You're building a tech product and eventually you're looking to become a regulated provider of that product.
Yeah.
And yes, focusing on the product is very important. Getting your investment is very important, but you need to have early strategic discussions with the right types of advisors so that you can avoid making incredibly costly mistakes. Most of what I see are, you know, businesses that have ended up spending millions and millions on things that if they had just had the right advice at the start, would not have happened. So, for example, choosing what is my regulatory hub going to be? Where do I want to base this business? That's something that you need to be thinking about at the earliest possible stages, because it kind of feeds into everything else, right? Like kind of fundraising are you going to be doing? What regimes do you need to follow?
Okay.
But also, who do you bring into the team? And it's very common that you'll have people that are, you know, purely with tech backgrounds, but they don't think to engage with people who have a lot of business experience.
Yeah.
Or who have previously dealt with, you know, running a regulated company, because yeah, there's just a whole extra layer of, yeah, of things that you have to deal with. And so, you know, not planning early enough will lead to you running out of money before you get your license. You might end up over hiring because you think, oh, we need to have people on the ground in these five jurisdictions, when really you could have just done it with one and expanded later.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really just, where do the pieces go, the timing, and it impacts everything down to, you know, your funding projections, your hiring plans, just all of it. So yeah, I mean, building the product, very, very important, but you need to take the time to step away and have those strategic discussions and be thinking about the business rather than being in the business. And that's really hard when you're a startup founder, right? I mean, you have no free time. It's crazy. Everyone's working all the time, but it is crucial.
Yeah. How do you convince in your conversations when you're trying to also get your clients on board with what you're trying to sell them? How do you convince them of this? Because it seems such a low priority in the beginning. For me, kind of as an entrepreneurial person, it's like not top of mind, right? Same with sustainability topics, by the way, but at the same time, like, this is not top of mind. So how do you actually sell your service to them?
Well, the same with sustainability, right? I mean, cleaning up a mess is always going to cost more than having just done it properly the first time.
Yeah.
And what I see is so many companies will spend millions on remediation projects that could have been completely avoided just by having gotten better advice at the start. So, you know, I don't usually come out the gate trying to convince clients that they need to have all of these things in place, but they'll usually come to us with a specific problem. Mm-hmm. And then when we start delving into the whys and the hows, I don't know, I guess this comes from my law background, but I just start asking questions. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's the regulatory approach too. And the more you start asking questions and delving into, you know, why things have been done the way they have, then you start to, I guess, see the light bulb switch on.
Yeah.
And then you can have some of these interesting discussions saying, well, you know, have you thought about doing this? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, maybe if you utilize this key function or split this function, you can actually save having to hire this additional person. And I don't know. I mean, people start seeing the possibilities pretty quickly once you delve into it.
Yeah. And do you usually get engaged at the, because I know this from my personal freelance experience as well, that you kind of selling yourself as, oh, I can help you set it up from the get-go. But then in reality, the time or the point in time that you get hired at actually is a different one, where it's maybe already too late or shit has already hit fan. So what's kind of the realistic time at which you usually get hired?
I mean, it really does vary. I've definitely come into the dumpster fire situations where people are just, it's reactive all the time. And that's just not a position you want your business to be in. It's not good for anybody, your employees or, you know, any of the strategic endeavors you're hoping to achieve.
Of course, yeah.
But I would say the best opportunity to have the most impact early on is when we're doing a licensing engagement. And it's those pre-discussions where you'll have a client saying, look, we're keen to expand from the US into Europe. Mm-hmm. We'd like to talk to you about what jurisdictions might make the most sense for us to base ourselves in. And then we start from there. So you do your, you know, geo expansion discussions, think about what would be the most suitable regulatory hub, and then start designing what the structure is going to look like.
And do you usually do that? Because I mean, that's the regulatory legal aspect is a part of it. The other part is kind of the financial aspect of it. What's beneficial in terms of taxes, for instance? How do you deal with that? Do you have like a team or is there anything you cover or how do you work with that?
Yeah, so we don't give legal advice. I always am careful to say this, even though I am a lawyer. I don't practice. So the good thing about this is I know what you need to get and how much it should cost. And that's the best thing about, I guess, our network is we have people all over the globe that we've worked with before. Yeah. So, you know, if you need someone who understands crypto tax, then yes, I can put you in touch with them. And, you know, we have a very good lists who are responsive, because that's the other thing. You don't want to be stuck waiting 3 weeks for an answer, right? Like you needed it yesterday. So yeah, I mean, where we need to pull in outside expertise, I'm definitely able to arrange that and point to where it's needed. And founders should expect that. Like, you're going to need some external legal advice. You're going to need some accounting. You'll need tax advice. Yeah. You know, it's just the basic stuff. But what I often see is that they don't understand that, you know, your lawyer is not your one-stop shop, I suppose. And also, I guess, not realizing that sometimes it might be better to have an in-house legal function who can oversee any of those external functions, because you will save so much money doing that as a startup. A lot of what needs to be done in terms of legal work should be done in-house, and you don't need to be paying exorbitant rates to have, you know, something simple like a terms of reference drafted by a big firm.
Okay. And how does this work when it comes to hiring? Because I mean, nobody's going to hire a lawyer like in the early stage, for instance, right? So how do you advise on that?
Thing is, they don't, but they should. So, I mean, that's one of the first things you should really think about, because some of the messes I've seen from companies really date back to not having had that internal expertise. So, you know, I had one client where we were going through all of their existing contracts that they had, and this was part of a due diligence, piece of work for external funding. And we looked through every single contract. Half of them they couldn't even find. The other half, you know, were executed with the wrong legal party and therefore weren't legally enforceable. Just a whole raft of things. And you can't expect your external lawyers to be looking out for that for you. That's not their role. Yeah. You know, it's an internal function that needs to be happening. So it's part operational, but it's also, you know, managing your legal risk, but also keeping costs down, because having one good salaried employee who is aware of these things and can at least keep track of it will save you so much.
Yeah.
And you don't have to go and get, you know, a GC that's got, you know, 10 plus years of experience. You could get, you know, a fairly junior lawyer who is interested and keen to learn. Right. Yeah. So it doesn't have to be a really big, expensive hire, but it is a function you should have.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, now that I think about it, I mean, for us, we also have our internal advisor. I mean, he's not full time, he's a freelancer, but same, that's been very, very crucial for us as well. Yeah. Fully understand. When I look at the proactive versus reactive, so we just covered the reactive part of compliance and risk. Let's cover a bit more of the proactive side of it. So I never heard about a regulatory business plan. Can you kind of walk me through what's the regulatory business plan and why do we need that?
Yes. I mean, anybody who's operated in the UK will probably be shuddering just hearing regulatory business plan, because the FCA loves them. Yeah. But you know, a regulatory business plan, it's just a normal business plan on steroids. It covers off the same basic components that a business plan does, but it also goes into some additional areas. And it also forces the business to think about their assumptions, to challenge those assumptions, and to make adjustments as needed. So things like we talked about before, like your geo expansion strategy, or, you know, how you're going to be monitoring regulatory change that would impact the business and could literally kill it. Those are the types of things you would put into your regulatory business plan.
Okay.
You know, it's not something you just do once either. And this is, I know it's easier said than done, because when you're in the business, you're just so busy. But having one that is up to date, and, you know, making sure you've got someone who's assigned as the owner of that plan and keeps it up to date will save you so much time. So any third party due diligence engagement, you just send over your regulatory business plan. You're applying for an authorization. Great. You can just attach that and then refer back to it in your application.
Makes sense.
You know, insurance, getting fintech insurance, it's actually harder than getting a license in some jurisdictions. But if you can hand over a nice updated, you know, regulatory business plan, that's basically all they want to know.
Yeah. Nice one. That's something I'm definitely going to put on my list to work on next. Talking about it, by the way. So one thing that now pops up in my head immediately is, okay, there's a, you can make a plan for regulation, But then how much can you really plan for it if you starting up with a business that is supposed to be out there for at least 3, 4, 5 years, maybe longer? So some of these things are incredibly hard to plan, of course. So how do
plan
we actually
plan for the unplanned? Yeah. I mean, this is what I always say is like, make sure, for example, that you have a litigation reserve and that you're putting money aside every month for that, because that's me as the former litigator. But it's the same for planning, for your financial projections. If you look at startup projections, they're pure conjecture, right? Yeah. And they're just based on assumptions about what might be happening and when. So you just need to build that same sort of approach into regulatory change. You could say, look, we can assume that at least, you know, once or twice a year, there might be some changes that we'll have to implement in our business, depending on where you operate, and, you know, build that into, I guess, how that might impact revenue and, you know, what you might need to do in terms of hiring. It's impossible to predict what the rules will actually be, but luckily you do tend to get a bit of a grace period before things are actually put into place.
Okay.
Yeah. But just, it's going to happen. You know, it's going to happen. So just a bit of a buffer.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the grace period probably also depends on which legislation you sit in Germany, probably.
Yeah. And also the company's reputation. Yeah. So, you know, there are some companies that already kind of put a bad taste in the mouth of regulators the world over. So you can expect probably a tougher approach for those. But if you're a newer business, you're just getting started, the regime isn't really that clear. You can expect that it's going to be more of an educative approach by the regulator, provided that, you know, there isn't any existing consumer harm that's tied back to you and what you're doing.
Talking about potholes, crypto regulation. So we have a bunch of course, because if we talk about regulation, the most fast moving industry is in fintech, of course, right now is crypto. And it still feels a lot like Wild Wild West, to be honest. I have every day, every new day, there's something new popping up. I have the feeling that I have no idea what's going on. And you mentioned a couple of interesting...
You're not the only
one. Yeah, I'm not the only one. Actually, I had Daniel Cunha a couple of days on weeks ago on the podcast, who's running Corp Dev at Mercado Bitcoin, which is the biggest LATAM kind of crypto broker. And he kind of summed up some of the things that are happening in that market as well, because regulation, of course, kind of the collaboration with the regulators, especially, is super important if you want to be a big player there. What you specifically mentioned is that you think crypto marketing will not survive regulation. So I was thinking, okay, crypto itself, you know, how will that survive regulation? And then you talk about crypto marketing. So why do you specifically refer to crypto marketing in this case?
Well, yeah, I mean, million-dollar question, right? But marketing is what people are using as their primary customer acquisition strategy, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because if you've worked in traditional finance, marketing is kind of a newer area because we're familiar with disclosure, right? Legally required things you must tell a customer before they're able to engage in your products and services. Well, crypto has largely escaped that until now.
Yeah.
And having looked at some of the practices that are common for commercial businesses, if you apply that to a regulated financial service, it just looks predatory, you know? How are you, making sure that vulnerable consumers are taken into account, that, you know, people know what they're actually getting into? And so you also have channels that have not previously been used for financial products, and they're not necessarily designed for disclosure. So when you have a character limit, for example, just a link to your giant disclosure document, no one's going to check that.
Yeah.
So it's really thinking about what would the average retail consumer understand from what you're saying. And this is why we're seeing so much activity, especially in the UK, around crypto ads being banned or pulled by the ASA and often in conjunction with the FCA, because they are blatantly misleading and not giving the information
that needs to be
given. Yeah. And people are losing a lot of money this way. So, they're putting some new rules in the UK that, you know, supposed to be live this summer, but probably a bit later. I think they just said actually they're going to push it back. But you will actually now have to have your advertising content and strategies approved before you can roll it out. And the approval mechanism is, I don't know if they've thought it through particularly well, but it has to be a certain type of firm that's authorized to make those approvals. And so existing VASPs in the UK, some of them might not have that ability. Yeah. So they'll have to actually go to an external company who will then have to look at their marketing materials and strategy and approve it before they can use it.
Interesting.
Well, who do you think is going to stick their neck out on that? You know, I mean, do you want to be blamed if things go badly?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just so much of that information is now outside of the control of the company. So, you know, organic growth is something that companies are always seeking, and it's great. But if you have people who are promoting your products and services, say on TikTok or something, and you've got no control over what they're saying, you know, it's a risk. You need to be aware of it.
Yeah.
But also people who've been engaging directly with crypto influencers, that's where I think we won't be seeing much of that, if at 100%. All, because the risk is too great.
Yeah. I mean, it has very strong early internet vibes right now. I'm always shocked because I usually don't really see ads because my ad blockers are pretty heavy. But whenever they're randomly turned off on a certain page, and I just see these ads for, okay, this is a guaranteed 1,000x return within 10 days or whatever. It's quite intense how scammy that is. And you really think, oh, that's a lot of retail investors who are burning their money probably right there.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, a lot of them probably are actual scams. And that's the hard part, right? How are you as a retail investor meant to distinguish between the two when they look the same? Yeah. But I would say probably the majority of what you're seeing probably are actually fraudulent scams to get people to give up, you know, their keys or anything, and they end up losing money through that as well. And that just puts distrust into the whole system anyway. But yeah, I mean, there are just a lot of nuances to crypto advertising that just haven't previously appeared in other financial models. Like, for example, I was reading the complaint with the class action suit for Ethereum Max, which was filed against Kim Kardashian and Floyd Mayweather, and then the company, and also some consultants to the company. And, you know, some of the things they spoke about there, one of them was actually presenting at a conference, at the Bitcoin conference in Miami. And you think about it, well, let's say someone puts a recording of your presentation online, and maybe you did give a disclaimer at the beginning, but, you know, that's been edited out. So how do you control third party information that's outside of, you know, what you're able to actually control? And that's, I think, the biggest issue with social media advertising and also other forms of advertising that are quite common these days.
Yeah, it's that's an interesting question, because I think it's also going to be taking away a bit of the sex appeal that crypto has right now, because it feels like this underground movement, almost this wild, wild west movement.
It's going to completely ruin it, and it stinks. You know, I totally get that, and I always feel like the fun police having to tell clients that, you know, you might not want to commit to this 12-month contract with this marketing agency, because I suspect that within 3 to 4 months, you won't be able to actually use their services anymore. And there seems to be a complete disregard within the marketing industry itself that this is coming. And that's a bit of a concern. But yeah, I mean, I've tried to help clients find good marketing agencies previously where they at least seem to have some sort of understanding of regulation and risk. Yeah. And there might be one I'm aware of globally.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of it also just boils down, not like, I mean, you mentioned it in one of your statements as well, it's corporate governance, but it's also that a bit of respect for the consumer, you know, because I mean,
and just that's honest, the thing, right? I mean, you should be thinking about the consumer and not just the consumer experience, which, you know, you spend a lot of time on UX design, but what about the rest of it? How do you build trust with a consumer? How do you keep them as a lifelong customer? Because, you know, this is what we're seeing now is business models are changing almost to what the traditional banking models were, which is you want a customer from the cradle to the grave. What other services and verticals can we build in to ensure that we're keeping them engaged? Because, you know, there's nothing worse than having 50,000 onboarded clients, but only 10% of them are actually active, right? Like that's an expense and a risk for companies. 100%. So I'm seeing a lot of creativity in strategic thinking as to how companies can bring in, you know, these younger investors, but offer them a good experience. And part of that very much is looking out for their best interests. If you're a legitimate company, then that should be no problem. Yeah. But as we've seen, there have been quite a few scams and some dodgy actors. And then that just kind of, again, paints the industry with a tarred brush.
100%. I think, even if you follow the crypto scene itself, I mean, it's part, being burned is kind of part of the game, you know? So it's like one out of five times you're going to get burned.
So, it's a badge of honor.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or shame, depending on what you got burned by. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big risk, big opportunities. It's always what, like, you mentioned actually just now, Tiana, that you feel like the fund police a little bit. And of course, it also applies to regulators as a whole. I mean, who wants to work for a regulator, right? So one thing you mentioned is that, like, the recruiting and retaining employees. So what's going on there, and what do you think is going amiss?
Yeah, well, so I'm actually working on an article right now about regulatory staff and the mass exodus that we're seeing globally of people leaving these agencies. And it's for a variety of reasons. And I would say, too, that, you know, it's aligning with existing market movements and employment, right? People are questioning the nature of work. You've got geographically distributed teams, hybrid work models. I mean, as a people manager, it's not a fun time. And regulators have the same problem. But there are also some unique things to regulatory agencies that can lead to frustration by their staff. And you know, a lot of it comes down to death by a thousand cuts. So like you were saying earlier about, you know, bureaucracy in Germany is a reason that some people tend to leave. Well, think about working in a place where you don't have the ability to make a decision. And in fact, a decision has to go through about 20 different channels before it's made. Over time, that does start to get to you, you know? Mm. And people who tend to work for regulatory agencies, they're often brilliant people who are creative and really want to be there to serve a wider purpose. You know, you take a bit of a pay cut to work there usually, but you want to make a difference in your work. And, you know, when I was there, most people came from top law firms, big four, investment banks, like very high quality people who have worked in the highest echelons of finance and business. And, you know, after a while, you start to think, gosh, this is just as frustrating as my previous role. Maybe I should just go back out and get twice as much money and also use the knowledge I've gained to, you know, add some value to a business where you have a bit more flexibility and agility to make decisions and make impacts.
Absolutely,
But it's a problem. So we've seen, for example, I think it was Hong Kong, something like 40% of their junior staff quit last year. Wow. The FCA, they went on strike recently, and it was only a very small percentage of the employees, but we've never seen that before. Since when do you see regulators in front of the building with Bob Marley blasting and protest signs? I mean, it's a unique situation we find ourselves in. So yes, I think there are some changes that regulatory agencies need to implement when it comes to keeping their employees happy and engaged. And part of that, I think, is making sure that, you know, you're not encouraging silos. So, you know, requiring more cross-functional work throughout the agency, which seems like it would be a given, but in places like the FCA, you'll have one team that has absolutely no idea what the other team is working on. So you end up with duplication of efforts and also inconsistent messaging, which is frustrating for the market.
Yeah.
And something else I think that regulators should really be thinking about is kind of taking that same approach that investment banks and big four do when it comes to their former employees. So it's really just a rebranding exercise, but someone leaves, well, now they're part of your alumni network and you can send them newsletters. You might have an annual drinks meetup, but you know, you're keeping tabs on what they're doing.
Yeah.
And then maybe they might come back and work for you again. Regulatory agencies should really be focusing on bringing back former staff members after they've been out in the wild for a couple of years. It just makes sure that the information is being kept fresh. It'll allow them to, you know, take on probably a more senior role after coming back. But I mean, this is really the target area they should be recruiting.
Yeah. So what I also have here in your words is that the exchange between private organizations and companies and the regulators has to be more often, right? That people have to, that the flow has to happen more right now. Is that understood? Or?
Yeah. I mean, there's a knowledge gap and it's vast and it just continues to grow because they don't have the technical expertise to keep up with something that, you know, even you or I who read about it every day still struggle to keep up with it, right? So how can you expect an agency to not only design new laws and frameworks and, you know, get the industry input that you have to get, while also, you know, keeping their staff trained? And it's just a lot. It's a lot for one person to know. Absolutely. And it can be intimidating. But yeah, I think learning and development opportunities, cross-functional projects, and possibly increasing graduate programs as well. Because, you know, now you've got students who are able to study and get degrees in, you know, blockchain or what have you. So why aren't we looking at getting those people in early? But yeah, you also need to hire from industry.
100%.
People often think that that's a conflict, and it can be in some cases if it's at a high enough level, but you know, you put measures in place to manage that conflict. But if you don't have this flow of information happening, then you're not going to get laws and regulations that suit your business, right? And industry knows it, but they're also too busy to be able to engage as much as they'd like. And then you end up paying the price later.
Makes sense. Let's close the conversation, talk about hierarchies, because you just also mentioned that that's frustrating often, especially for more ambitious personnel to stay in, within regulators. On the flip side, you also now said that flat hierarchies have no place in a regulated business model. And of course, that's a bit of the opposite of what fintech often claims to be. Fintech is so fast; it's all lean. It's very fast. It's like hierarchies, the new generation. You know, I mean, I say new generation, like our generation, the younger generation after us. For them, flat hierarchies are kind of seem to be the given almost. You know, so in some countries more than others. But why do you think? And what's going on there? So why what's your problem? What's your problem with flat hierarchies, Gianna?
You and you know, I like the idea. I like the democratic aspect of it. And I think in tech, when you have teams that are, you know, working on a product, it makes perfect sense to have a flat hierarchy across a lot of those teams. But at the end of the day, you have to have a business owner for a function, right? Otherwise, who's going to make the decision? And this is ultimately what I see happening in a lot of these companies is you reach a point of decision inertia, and it's because no one will take ownership of a, of a function. And therefore, you know, you might have six people that you have to ask, can we go ahead and do X? No one's willing to stick their neck out and make that decision. And so all that does is frustrate your employees. It slows down progress. But it also means that when a regulator is looking at your business, like the first thing they're going to ask you is, who is the business owner for X? You know, who makes the decisions in this particular area? So, yeah, you can have a majority flat organizational structure if you really want to, but you still have to put someone's name or a role as being responsible for things like legal, compliance, IT security, et cetera. If you don't, you won't get a license, but you also can't run your business.
That makes sense. So it's important to put a name tag to something, especially in regular environments. Tiana, I learned a lot about regular environments. Sorry, I cut you off, Jack.
No, I was going to say too. I mean, you imagine onboarding new employees, and you know, they say, "Who do I talk to you about this?" And you actually don't know what to tell them. It's not helpful. I just think it kills productivity. So yeah, I don't want there to be unnecessary layers for approvals, but you still have to have someone who is the approver.
I think especially navigating that environment while still maintaining growth, I think that's a critical part. How do you kind of maintain the good organizational structure for regulators while also keeping headcount kind of lean?
Well, I mean, scaling up, right? How are you supposed to scale if you haven't got at least some semblance of a structure? So what I always tell boards when I work with them is you're here to be doing the strategic thinking, right? You shouldn't be working in the business as much. And yes, we have executive directors, but once you get to a certain point, you need to be saving your energy for the strategic vision of the business. That means you have to delegate decision-making authority to the person below you. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck doing all of this operational work and not actually running the company. And so that's the biggest mistake I see when it comes to hyper-growth companies is they're not delegating authority for decision-making at an appropriate pace, and then it just holds everything up.
Yeah, that makes sense. Tiana, I learned a ton. If people want to connect with you and learn more from you, what can they do? Where can they find you?
You can find us online. We have a website, swotteamconsulting.com. Mm-hmm. And that's SWOT. So yes, SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses over time. Yeah, it's kind of one of those nerdy things that people get it, but we try not to make too big of a deal out of it. But yeah, swotteamconsulting.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn. And yeah, we're here to help.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Tiana.
Yeah, no worries. It was always good talking to you. And yeah, I look forward to seeing what you have on next week.
Thank you for joining us in the OpenIC. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also leave a review. That really helps. And connect with us for feedback on fintalent.io. See you next time.